Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and its kingdom. Of course, top of the list of enemies foreign, with a reach domestically as well, is the Chinese Communist Party. We did a fascinating webinar of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, on Tuesday of this week. And I wanted to commend it to all of our listeners because it addresses a form of unrestricted warfare that, well, is not generally recognized as such, and yet is very, very much part of the arsenal that the Chinese Communist Party is wielding against us at the moment. I'm very pleased to say we have with us a man who knows a lot about the Chinese Communist Party and more generally about its stratagems and the techniques that it is advancing to take down the United States, who happens also to have a background, among many other things, in the telecommunications business and therefore is probably particularly well suited to talk with us a little bit about TikTok, an app that is on countless millions of American kids' cell phones and utilized relentlessly by them for entertainment and, well, other purposes, which we'll be talking about. Our guest is Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired. He is also a former Foreign Service officer, as well as a businessman with, among other places, Motorola out in East Asia. He knows the region well, and as I say, is one of our members of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, and its duty experts on the Chinese communists and what they're up to. And Colonel, it's always great to have you with us. Happy Thanksgiving. We're speaking on the eve of it, and I'm always pleased to have a chance to say hello under any circumstances, but you're one of the people I'm particularly thankful for, so we're delighted to have you today.
Okay, nice to be here. Thanks very much.
Thank you. So, Colonel, there's now a growing ferment, I think it's fair to say, in national security circles in the United States, at least, that this seemingly, well, purveyor of silly dance videos, micro videos at that, is now actually a threat not only to the users, but to the nation and its security as well. Why is that?
Well, there's a few things that you always hear about TikTok, and one is that it allows the Chinese to gather all sorts of personal information of its users. And plus, you do have to recognize that when you can get access to one part of somebody's personal telecommunications network as it is, usually the clever guys can find a way to get access to other parts of it. It's not so, you know, they're smarter than we are. But there's another part that really is...
Could I just say on that point, I think that they're certainly getting access to your camera and your microphone and the contents of what you have on your phone, which in the hands of people who are specialists, as you say, in this collecting big data, mining it, and utilizing it, weaponizing it, really, that can be a very formidable thing in its own right, let alone whatever else it may get into without your permission.
That's right. It's a bit like letting someone into your house, you know, just to tell them, well, stay in the living room. Well, maybe they won't. But there's something that's gotten attention recently, finally, is the usefulness of TikTok for indoctrinating, for influencing its users. And the way one way to think about this is that, you know, people these days get their information, or a lot of people, particularly younger people, get information from their device. Used to be everybody read newspapers, literally everybody did, or they watched the evening news. And there weren't these other channels to get influenced other than by, you know, Madison Avenue advertisements to buy cornflakes and leisure suits and stuff. But what you're getting now is many fewer sources of information for the average person to shape their thinking. And if much of this comes from TikTok, well, that's pretty good if you're the Chinese. You know, you get these messages, you know, you start to hear, you never hear the bad things about China. You hear the bad things about America. Instinctively, almost intuitively, you get this idea that of how the world is. And that America has no enemy from China, but America itself is an evil place that needs fixed, needs destroyed first and then fixed. And if you can gradually over time, almost imperceptibly shape thinking, that to me is the real plus side for TikTok if you're the Chinese.
In this webinar, we talked about that precise point and the kind of subliminal content that is being purveyed that people may not even be aware they're taking aboard. And yet, particularly, I did a commentary today talking about, are you wondering why is it that America's young people seem overwhelmingly now to favor socialism as a form of governance against all of the evidence of its horrors? And I have to believe that at least some of this is because the Chinese, with their emphasis on socialism with Chinese characteristics, as they like to say, are endlessly promoting it on platforms, including TikTok now. Colonel, one of the things that I guess worries me about this is that if the combination of data collection and the algorithms that are used to learn about you and what you like, and particularly what you are interested in seeing on TikTok, and they can manipulate that content to make it more addictive, and then it's used as a platform for delivering this kind of subversive propaganda, we're talking about a very dangerous weapon in an unrestricted warfare program like the Chinese have, as you say, for the purposes of destroying our country. And what's really interesting is that, as we illuminated in this program, and again, people can see the video of this webinar at presentdangerchina.org, is the Chinese have a very different content stream for their own kids, whose time on this and other social media apps is very restricted, as I understand it as well. What do we know about the contrast between what they want their own kids to take aboard through this particular platform and what they're endlessly feeding ours?
Well, it has gotten some coverage, you know, and it's what you would expect. You know, it's the domestic audience in China would never hear anything about sort of individual liberties, the freedom of speech and thought, etc., these basic fundamentals of America. And, you know, she even said in it was a speech he gave, and then it was written up in document form. It's called Document 9. It was written in 2013, back when our experts all thought she was going to be a great reformer. He said that, basically, he said that things like democracy, consensual government, the freedoms that we take for granted, he listed these things. These are the enemy, and that there'll be no part of China and we're going to destroy them. That is effectively what he said. And so you're going to make sure that nothing that could influence the Chinese population to see, to think or get any ideas other than what the Chinese Communist Party approves is going to appear on a Chinese app or within China. And that's really the fundamental thing. It's as if it's kryptonite, that it just will not be allowed in if they can do it. Well, and they're pretty good at it.
Yeah, it's all of that, you know, demeaning us, of course, but it's also endlessly touting the China model, patriotism, you know, achievement, personal and academic and otherwise, which is so contrasting to what they're using to sort of indoctrinate our kids to be indolent and anti-American. Colonel, we have to take a short break. We'll be right back with more with Colonel Grant Newsom on the other side of this message. Stay tuned. This is Frank Effney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Have you wondered why America's young people think their country is systematically racist? China had nothing to do with the pandemic that has killed more than a million of us, and socialism is a preferable form of governance? Such widespread misapprehensions may have something to do with the fact that our kids are being insidiously, comprehensively, and highly effectively brainwashed by the Chinese Communist Party as part of its unrestricted warfare aimed at destroying the United States. A truly mind-blowing webinar conducted yesterday by our Committee on the Present Danger of China illuminated how the CCP has weaponized a highly addictive app called TikTok. It uses sophisticated big data collection and analysis and powerful artificial intelligence to hook, indoctrinate, and otherwise subvert coming generations of Americans, even as TikTok's content inside China promotes instead patriotism, academic excellence, and personal achievement. Ban TikTok now. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. We're speaking with a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy. I'm proud to say his name is Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired. We're talking with him about some of his insights and experiences in East Asia that have informed his very, very profound concern about the Chinese Communist Party, the threat that it poses, well, to us, but also to the region and the free world more generally. And Grant, I wanted to talk with you a bit about a recent exercise that has been conducted between elements of the Japanese Defense Forces and the United States military that you took some heart from. I know you've been very concerned about whether the Japanese are really stepping up. Well, even as you're concerned about whether we're stepping up in the face of the dangers that the Chinese Communist Party under Xi Jinping, which, as you say, really we were on notice about going back to 2013 at least, are now coming to a point where it may come to blows. Talk about this exercise, if you would, sir.
Sure. Well, what it is an exercise called Keen Sword, and it's held every 2 years between the Japanese and the Americans. Principally, it's been the navies operating together, but in recent times, more recent times, it's been the Marines getting involved and the Japanese Army getting involved. So it's a more joint, a more complex operation than it's been. And you also saw this year, it was the British, the Canadians, and the Australians each played some part in it. And that too is new. The significance of Keen Sword is that it exercised in the way you fight a war, and it was bigger and, I say, more complex in the sorts of operations that they practiced. And there was a very clear sense, even though nobody had to say it, that this was all about China. But you've never seen us actually get together and really get ready to fight, in effect. There's, of course, an awful long way to go, but this was a good thing to see. You know, as critical as I often am about the Japanese preparations, and I would say that don't read too much into Keen Sword, because they still have an awful lot to do to be able to fight a war. But this was good to see. And particularly, you'll note that nobody in the public in Japan was complaining. Nobody in the government was complaining about this. So while they fuss about what they're going to do and the laws and changing regulations, you find that actually the militaries of our two nations and a few other friends are actually moving ahead and getting ready. So while things don't go the way you'd always like them to go, it is progress in the right direction. There's some good work done on both the Japanese and the American sides to get this done.
What you're saying there, and I think it's really important to tease it out, is that in the past, one of the legacies of World War II, of course, and the constitution that Douglas MacArthur wrote for Japan after it was defeated in that war, essentially said Japan is not going to have another military capable of really doing much other than self-defense in the narrowest sense of the word. That has been changing inexorably over time, notably with former Prime Minister Abe's very concerted efforts to give the Chinese military real capability, including for power projection. But you're indicating, Grant, and I think it's an important thing to note, that the people of Japan now evidently not only are pulling in behind that idea of Abe's, but also that they are recognizing that the threat from China is such that they can't afford to do otherwise any longer. Is that right?
That's right. I think the Japanese public actually is way ahead of the political class, and that's always been the case when it comes to defense. In fact, you know, ask them, well, should Japan have a proper defense? And the answer is, well, yeah, why not? And they'd be astonished to know that it doesn't have a proper defense. And you'll find that actually it's partly the influence of World War II, which was just a god-awful catastrophe for the Japanese. But that was 75 years ago. But it is as much actually successful Chinese political influence efforts against Japan's political class over 50, 60 years that has been very successful. So there you've actually got a very tolerant, if not pro, attitude towards Japan within large parts of that class. There's large parts, of course.
Towards China, you mean?
Yes, that's right, towards China. Right. So it's been very successful on the Chinese part. But there's a lot of the political class that doesn't think that way. But they have. So what you find is Japanese public and the Japanese government are sort of at different positions in terms of China. But that is changing. And so we're seeing it happen. It doesn't quite happen fast enough as we would like. But there is a shift, and it's something that long-term observers of Japan would not believe.
As you know, we've been talking a lot in recent months about elite capture in our country. And it's very interesting to hear that this is not reserved to our own leadership, political and business and so on, but it's a playbook that the Chinese are utilizing elsewhere, including in allied nations like Japan. Speaking of our allies, South Korea, not too far from Japan, is now being beset, well, as are the Japanese as well, I guess, by increasingly aggressive behavior from North Korea. Missile tests, including some that, you know, arc over the Japanese homeland. We have a very long range, apparently quite capable ballistic missile, intercontinental range ballistic missile that the North Koreans just fired. And every day seems to bring some new provocation. I'm wondering what you think is going on in this regard, Grant, especially if, as we've talked about with you consistently, China is moving inexorably in the direction of kinetic conflict over Taiwan, presumably, but with us, with Japan, who knows South Korea, who knows who else. Would you anticipate that the North Koreans, and perhaps an explanation for what they're doing at the moment, is sort of teeing up a new front that would be distracting, that would be, well, perhaps even disabling to the allies in the event that China does decide to go for it?
Yes. I'm afraid that for too long, the thinking has been, well, China is as perplexed as we are about North Korea. They would like to do something, but they can't do anything. You know, what influence do they have? I think that's wrong. I think it always has been. And particularly, though, in the last 10 years, at least, it's as wrong as it could possibly be. But in recent times, I think what you're seeing in this much more aggressive North Korean behavior is directly tied into China's objectives, and that there's either an explicit or an implicit agreement or approval from China that North Korea will start shooting things off and rattling the sabers, as you think about it. And this certainly distracts American and Japanese and everyone else's attention from anything else China is doing. And it also makes us think, well, we need to go easy on China, say, when it comes to Taiwan, because we need their help with North Korea. The Chinese just must be rolling on the floor laughing.
Well, The trouble is, it's worse than that, as you know. It's that they must be contemptuous of us. And I think they are, and that's sort of their default setting anyway towards barbarians. But it's ominous that this would be presumably a further inducement to them to act aggressively in their own right. But just going back to what you said, and very briefly, you talked about us thinking that they didn't have much influence with them. That seems to alternate. We also, from time to time, thought that if we just, you know, engaged them enough, they would bring the North Koreans to heel. Both seem to be wrong, that they have in mind using the North Koreans, whom they've armed with nuclear weapons, let's face it, who they've armed with ballistic missile technology, and whom they, I think, regard as a very convenient ally in this conflict that may be forthcoming at their hands. Grant Newsom, we have to leave it at that, I'm sorry to say. There's so much more to talk with you about. We appreciate our visits. As I say, we're very thankful for them, and we look forward to doing so after the holiday. Have a great one, my friend. Godspeed. We'll be right back with more. Stay tuned.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back. It's always my pleasure to say we are joined by Elaine Donnelly, a woman I've come to admire tremendously over the years. She is the founder and president of an indispensable organization, the Center for Military Readiness. She has served on both secretary level and presidential level commissions over the years, trying to help inform very important decisions about and by the U.S. military concerning issues like, well, women in combat and what kinds of gender norming should be done by the military and other matters that affect not only, unfortunately, the morale, the unit cohesionness, the readiness of our armed forces in ways that most of us have no idea about, but we need to. And her work at the Center for Military Readiness, I think, has proven to be a great vehicle for understanding that. We're always grateful to her for taking the time to talk with us a bit about that work, especially at moments when it is being recognized either by being explicitly acknowledged or simply purveyed by others, including some very senior legislators in the United States Congress at the moment. So, Elaine, congratulations on that. I want you to talk about these, tacit, if not explicit, recognitions of the important work you're doing, and more broadly, the message that is now being conveyed by those legislators.
Thank you, Frank. People are becoming more aware that our military has problems, that it's not just about the how many planes and ships and submarines there are. There is a social problem in the military, a division of opinion about what is the military for. The faction that is in charge right now under the Biden Biden administration, actually it's a continuation of
it's
Obama's
easy to get them
administration.
Yeah. Third term, some say.
Right. We're going into the 10th year now. The priorities were shifted, and this went back to 2011, when the military decided that diversity would be a strategic imperative. A report was issued that year, a very influential report. It's quoted all the time. Whenever the Pentagon introduces a bad idea, it's usually connected to something called the Military Leadership Diversity Commission, which was a project done in 2011. Fast forward to now. Here's the antidote, or at least the first step. This came out just in the last couple of days. It's called Woke Warfighters: How Political Ideology is Weakening America's Military. And two senior legislators, Senator Marco Rubio and Representative Chip Roy, issued this. Now, it doesn't have a whole lot of pages, but all the topics that we've been writing about for the last 2 years are in this document. And I'm delighted to see it because it could be the first step in getting priorities back where they belong. But the new Congress, and we can talk about this later, the new Congress will have its work cut out for it because there has to be a change in direction. But the issues...
Well, let me just come back to what you said. It's not just that they're talking about the issues that you've been writing about, warning of, and calling attention to, but as I understand it, they've largely tracked with your own thinking, your own critiques, and your own recommendations about fixes, no?
Well, I was delighted to see, even starting last year and especially this year, a number of amendments were put forward to eliminate things that are in this report, things like diversity, inclusion, and equity programs that are relentless and that turn priorities upside down, critical race theory to get rid of critical race theory programs, especially at the service academies, to get rid of the diversity quotas that distort everything, and to deal with issues of women in combat, the training and combat, the Army Combat Fitness Test. Senator Tom Cotton and Mike Waltz took the lead in dealing with that issue. That last one I just mentioned did get into the defense bill, which likely will become law. The other ones didn't. They failed by only a vote or two. So that's going to be part of the agenda of the next administration to deal with things that are being defended. Remember General Mark Milley, when he sat there in testimony before Congress, defending critical race theory instructions at the service academies. It was astonishing and disturbing to see, and it was just a few weeks later that the debacle in Afghanistan occurred. Instead of thinking about how to prevent that in Afghanistan, here was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff saying, well, I do want to know about those extremists, and his priorities are so skewed. It's ridiculous. It really was a laughingstock. But I think other members of Congress said, wait a minute, we're not going to allow this to go much further. And issuing this report, I think, is a good first step.
It's vital, needless to say. And the course correction that you're talking about is what I'd like to turn to with you next, Elaine. But recognize you've got a problem is obviously the first and critical step to getting the problem addressed. And I just can't say enough about, I think, how the Center for Military Readiness has really been keeping the flame on all of this. Your work, often underappreciated, but certainly impactful, has been incalculably important in that regard.
And thank you, Frank.
For it. And to turn to what you say Congress has been trying to do, and what it now needs to do with one of the houses, at least narrowly in the control of Republicans, is what I wanted to get to next, Elaine. The defense authorization bill is always must-pass legislation. It's expected to get completed and enacted as a result of the lame duck session they're now in. If it's not everything that one would want? Does it have things in it that we don't want? And either way, looking forward, how do we need to see this House of Representatives, building on the work of Chip Roy and Marco Rubio and you, of course, and Tom Cotton, for that matter,
yes,
as well?
Yes.
How should they proceed?
Well, the first thing they should do is do no harm. And that means they've got to defeat, take out, strip out, draft our daughter's legislation that would redefine the purpose of Selective Service at a time of national emergency. We would be calling up 50-50 groups of people, most of whom on the women's side are not qualified for the rigors of combat if it ever becomes necessary to draft anyone. But that legislation, it keeps coming up every year. It needs to be defeated again as it was last year. The NDAA, for the most part, is not as bad.
Is it in the legislation?
It is in the Senate bill. The Senate Armed Services Committee did approve an amendment, again by Senator Reid, to draft our daughters, include them in registration for Selective Service, not an actual draft. That legislation has to be taken out.
Is this in the process, Elaine? There's a conference going on, and they're sorting.
They haven't had a floor vote, and they may not have a floor vote in the Senate because last year, and if they do it again this year, the top four legislators got together and decided what they were going to do to get enough votes to get the NDAA passed. So the Republicans successfully pressured to not only remove Draft Our Daughters, but legislation endorsing DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, and CRT, all these bad programs. The Republicans just pulled all that bad stuff out. And that way they did manage to get sufficient bills. It's a little complicated because some Democrats always vote against the defense bill. So we don't know what will happen behind the closed doors, whether it will happen before the end of the year, or it may be even put off till next year, according to some people saying, well, let's just put it off until the new Congress comes in. That's probably not likely. They need to keep the pressure up, though, and get the bad stuff out of the bill. I would like to see the provision there that Senator Tom Cotton put in there, and he has an excellent book out now. It's called Only the Strong, and he talks about the strength of the military being diminished because of social agendas going on in the military. So what he wants to do is straighten out.
I gather he acknowledges your work as part of the
book. He did,
right?
Which I appreciated very much. Also,
that's
James
terrific.
Hassan, who wrote an excellent book. The first step to straighten out combat fitness test anomalies is to make sure that we don't have double standards for combat training. It's that simple. And steps are going to be taken next year if this becomes law. I suspect that it will. You know, if you look at this, I always think of it as sort of a metaphor. Back in 2011, the ship of state in the military went 2 degrees off course, and it's been going off course ever since. What the new Congress needs to do is restore that ship to the right bearing, to the right direction. It won't happen overnight, but they have to get back into the right ocean. And what does that mean? We need a military that is prepared to defend our country, not loaded down and held back by social agendas, by kicking people out of the military if they don't get a COVID shot. Thousands of good people are being kicked out of the military.
Or they don't have the right ideological inclinations
right.
as determined by this administration.
We have to get rid of that. We have to get rid of, as this report says, critical race theory instructions that pit people against each other based on racial assumptions. You assume, or people are supposed to assume, a person who is white has certain attitudes and a person who is black may be less than competent. This is so racist. I feel uncomfortable even saying it. And yet that is the nugget that is behind critical race theory. It pits racial groups against each other. How it got into the military is a story in itself.
Well, it's a Marxist revolution. That's how it got into the military. And I think you're right to take it back at least to the Obama years. And if we don't get the military back to being a meritocracy and one that is rooted in the principle of being ready to fight the enemies of this country, heaven help us.
Yeah.
Because we won't have one that is up to the job. Elaine Donnelly, you are instrumental in making sure that we do have a military that we need. God bless you for that. Keep up the great work at the
Center for Military
Readiness. CMRlink.org is where you can learn more about Elaine and her work. God bless you. Have a very happy Thanksgiving.
And you too.
We'll talk with you afterwards. God bless you. Be right back with more right after this. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the content of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the war of ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at the American Family Network, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. We're back. We're going to turn our attentions now to the Middle East, ever-present challenge, I think it's fair to say, to those of us who love freedom, not least because the outpost of freedom in that region, Israel, is, well, seemingly constantly under assault by its enemies. And we are now in the process of witnessing what seems to be a new surge of violence perpetrated against Israel from inside the country at the hands of Palestinians who, I think it's fair to say, more or less explicitly acknowledge their desire to destroy the Jewish state. When we talk about the Middle East, we always are given to talking with David Wormser about the subject. Dr. David Wormser is a very distinguished national security practitioner, a naval intelligence officer in the past, in the reserves now, with our Center for Security Policy. Between times, he has worked in senior civilian posts in the Office of the Vice President and the National Security Council and the State Department. A man who knows his way around Washington, that's for sure, but also the Middle East. It's always great to have a chance to catch up with him. David, I thank you for the work you do at our Center for Security Policy, directing our Middle East program, and for sharing your insights with us periodically here on this program. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you.
And a happy Thanksgiving to you and your family.
And everybody who's viewing.
Thank you. Let me ask you first and foremost, David, about this, uptick, shall we say, in the violence being perpetrated by Palestinians against Israelis in the form of terrorism, I guess, in the central bus depot in Jerusalem. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, we've seen an uptick already for the last 9 months. Probably the worst wave of terrorism Israel's had in over a decade. That said, what you're seeing in the last 2 days is an uptick on the uptick. You had four attempts at a terrorist attack. The first one was yesterday morning. It was a car bomb. Fortunately, it misfired and went up in flames as it was approaching its target, and never hurt anybody but the person in the car, the suicide bomber. The second one was in a kidnapping. There was an Israeli, Druze Israeli, not Jewish. Two guys were driving in a car in the West Bank near Jenin, and their car overturned. They were brought to the hospital in Jenin. The Palestinians sent one of them home. He was in critical condition. The Israelis extracted him. But the second one was kidnapped and then subsequently died. And they're holding the what's called the Lion's Den terrorists, are actually holding his body hostage right now. So that's terrorist attack number two. And then three and four were right this morning when you had two bombs, regular bombs, not car bombs, that were detonated near the bus depot. The first one claimed the life of a 16-year-old and may yet claim the life of his friend, who's also 16. He's in critical condition, hanging on by a thread. And then there were three or four more seriously wounded. So we're seeing a real wave suddenly again inside an already increased wave of terror. And when these things come, you ask why? These are not spontaneous. So somebody wants a war. Is it Hamas? Is it Abu Mazen? Is it Iran? And the answer probably is, to some extent, everybody has a reason right now to go to war on the Palestinian side. Or their
Abu Mazen, of course, being the putative president of the Palestinian Authority, the partner for peace, we're told.
Yeah.
And you're suggesting that he is among those who is engaged or in support of, at least, of sort of jihad against Israel. David, to the extent that this is taking place, does this suggest not only an increase in the interest of Israel's enemies to wage war, as you put it, against her, but also a diminution of the security apparatus in Israel that has, to this point, I think quite effectively kept those kinds of threats at bay, the security wall being an important part of that. But what's going on that this is taking place inside Israel proper?
I mean, not to weigh in a partisan way, but every time the left in Israel comes to power, its security situation collapses. It is a consistent at this point. And we're not talking about a sort of a collapse. We're talking about a sudden bloodbath that emerges. And part of it is because they still maintain this idea that the PLO and Abu Mazen want peace, but they're just a little weak, so they need to be reinforced so that they can finally make the sort of peace that they really want to make. And what they don't understand is all the goodwill gestures and loosening of security and the stuff they do to try to reinforce Abu Mazen gives him the power and encourages others to wage war. So it's a direct consequence of that idea.
Okay. Well, now 2 points. One is, of course, we've just had Benjamin Netanyahu return to power, so the right will be in charge going forward. And secondly, David, to the extent that this has been happening on the left's part in Israel, of course, it's also very much a function of the left's influence in Washington as well, is it not? Talk a little bit about the administration and its role in all of this.
Well, when there's light of day between the Israelis and the Americans, the Arab side tends to try to drive itself into that wedge. And the best way to do it is to escalate into war. Because they know then at that point the United States doesn't really have Israel's back. Even if the United States sends a lot of weapons to Israel, it then is usually attached to an effort by the United States to impose on Israel greater concessions on the Palestinians. So there's a no-lose.
To reward, in effect.
A reward. There's a no-lose. It's a no-lose circumstance for them. So there's always an incentive to go to war when there's an American administration that is so obsessed with the peace process and distances itself from Israel in the process.
David, we have to take a short break. I want to come back and talk with you about what the administration is doing vis-a-vis Iran that is contributing to all of this as well. Also, just to make mention of an important new initiative of a team of organizations, including ours, called CRUISER. It's the Committee to Renew the U.S.-Israel Special Relationship. CRUISER, CRUISR.info. Check it out, folks. We'll be right back with more with David Wormser right after this. Well, Welcome back. We're talking about the Middle East with one of our most experienced, knowledgeable, and valued colleagues with expertise in that region, Dr. David Wormser. He these days directs the Middle East programs at our Center for Security Policy. And David, you mentioned in passing there a moment ago that Iran is interested in war with Israel. The United States government is interested in propping up the government of Iran, even in the face of the growing evidence of the deep hostility towards it of the Iranian people. In fact, I woke up to a report, really quite remarkable, given the source, from National Public Radio today, talking about, very sympathetically, really, the experiences of quite a number of Iranians who have been brutalized by the regime for protesting what it's up to, as well as a prominent Iranian expat in this country saying that the revolution there is now set on removing this government, which would be in our interest as well as the people of Iran's. What is up with all of this, and how is it contributing to the problem we just discussed, and more broadly, turmoil in the Middle East?
Well, yeah, absolutely. When you hear the slogans and the behavior and what they're saying inside Iran and the revolutionary circles there, the ones who are rising up, as well as the real opposition who's expatriate, not the ones who were really carrying water for the regime, like Nayak or Barbara Slavin or others, but the real opposition who really cared about Iran, they all are saying the same thing, which is ever since roughly 5 years ago, they gave up on reform. They gave up on the idea of reform. There was only one way to go, which was revolution. And moreover, what you're seeing, the slogans inside Iran, is that the worst outcome for them is if the regime survives now. For them, it is such a disaster, it would be such a misery that it's not worth living, which is why you're seeing Iranians literally run into bullets and run through gauntlets of club-wielding thugs to try to overthrow the government, because they really have lost all hope otherwise. There's no other option for them.
And they're likely to die either way, whether exactly. It's protesting or whether it's for being punished.
Exactly. And those who might survive don't see it worth living. So it really is such a miserable place. And I think when the lid comes off, we'll realize that the misery was 1,000 times and brutality was 1,000 times more than what we had heard.
But this makes all the more important, doesn't it, David, that we're aligned with the people of Iran, not allowing that misery to be further intensified, let alone crushingly so.
Yes. Well, and the biggest danger right now is, and you see it, you've seen a few government statements from Iran talking about the moderates again, that the hardliners will yield to the moderates. And you're hearing some of the apologists for Iran say, well, yes, you know, we really need to make sure that the regime changes rather than change the regime. So what you're seeing is a concerted campaign by the Iranian government to snooker us into this moderate hardline shibboleth again. And unfortunately, our administration, if you read between the lines of what their policy is, even the harshest statements they make are calling on the Iranian regime to behave in this way or that way. In other words, our policy is that the Iranian regime survives, but that it needs to be a little sobered and chastened, and it needs to now behave better and hopefully therefore also enter a nuclear deal. There's no statement in the United States that indicates our policy has shifted toward a regime change strategy.
This is a travesty, David, and I think it's a problem, as you said earlier, for Israel. It's a problem for others in the region, as well as for us. But staying with the region for a moment, David, talk a little bit about what's going on with Qatar at the moment. There seems to be charm offensive underway in connection, or at least accompanying, this World Cup soccer tournament that's taking place there. The Saudis are among those being romanced, and apparently the United States government is very prone to that as well. Your thoughts?
About a half year ago, we declared Qatar to be a major non-NATO ally, which didn't make a lot of sense. There was nothing really about Qatar's behavior that justified that. They were involved with Hamas, with Al-Qaeda, remnants, ISIS remnants. They're involved with Iran deeply.
Muslim Brotherhood.
They're really a bad actor and really a problem in the region, apart from also being a nemesis to Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and the Abraham Accords countries. So I never understood why they were suddenly raised to the same level that, say, Israel is as an ally. And then, since then, what you see is they keep cropping up in every single initiative we take in the region, whether it's the Lebanon peace, Lebanon-Israeli gas agreement, whether it's some new initiative on the Palestinians, and now with the World Cup. Yeah, I think we're trying to get them to come to terms with the Saudis. And the Saudis, of course, are trying to hedge and figure out how they can navigate their survival in a hostile American administration. So they're,
which means separate pieces with some of those that are rather hostile to us. And I would put Qatar in that category, even though we do have a major military installation, an air base there, and have been associated with them in military matters for some time. But David, I think this has to do at some level with the influence of the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States government, trying to help their principal sponsor, better its position vis-a-vis the United States, don't you think?
Yeah, politics is personnel. And at the end of the day, we see who is the Middle East team. It is Maher Bitar is the senior director for intelligence at the White House, used to work for the United Nations Relief Works Agency, UNRWA, the Palestinian Hamas front, essentially. Money flowing in from Qatar there. You have Hedi Amar, you go down the list. And they've all had deep ties to the, or been on record as apologists for the Muslim Brotherhood's influence in the United States. And ultimately, I think it's also tied into the progressives in Congress, who also seem to have deep ties to the Qataris, despite their progressive ideology.
And the hostility of the Qataris to homosexuality, for example, among other things.
And every other progressive
agenda item, yeah. It's cynical in the extreme and I think very counterproductive at that. David, we have to let it go at that for the moment. Thank you for joining us. Come back to us with updates in the near future. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
You too.
Thanks to all of you as well. We're deeply grateful to you for your participation in these programs. We'll look forward to talking with you on the other side of the holidays. And go forth and multiply.